Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now going to cover 1 Samuel chapter 25, verses 1 through 44, the story of David and Abigail. Our context is this. David is continuing to be on the lam from Saul. Saul has just chased him down to En-Gedi, right there on the shores of the Dead Sea, the western shore, halfway between the northern and southern tip. David was hiding in a cave that Saul went in to relieve himself, and David cut off a piece of Saul's cloak and said, "Look here, I could have killed you if I wanted to, but I didn't, so therefore know that I'm not in rebellion against you." And Saul, in a fit of temporary repentance, goes back to Gibeah and leaves David alone, and David then retreats. Now, there's a question here whether he goes back to Maon, where he had come from, to get to En-Gedi. If you take the road from En-Gedi and go due east about 6 miles or so, 6-7, you hit the road that runs south from Hebron, and it goes, the first city you hit, the first village you hit is Carmel, and then you go south for about a mile or so, maybe 2 miles, I don't know, not very far. You hit Maon, and I'm going to take it as Maon, not Paran, that David went to after he spared Saul's life at En-Gedi. So we start now in 1 Samuel 25, verse 1. "Then Samuel died, and all Israel gathered together and mourned for him and buried him at his house in Ramah. And David arose and went down to the wilderness of..." Well, the NASB has Paran. The Masoretic text, the Hebrew manuscripts have Paran. The Septuagint Greek translations of the Greek manuscript of the Hebrew manuscripts have Maon. The Septuagint has Maon. Some translations follow that. The NAB, New American Bible, the Bible in Basic English have it as Maon. I think Maon makes more sense because it's closer. The wilderness of Paran, you have to go south of the Dead Sea, and you're in that desert area between the Dead and the Red Sea, namely the Gulf of Aqaba, branch of the Dead Sea down there. It's the wilderness. You have to go through the wilderness of Zin, Z-I-N, Zin, and then you have to go south of that wilderness to get to the wilderness of Paran right before you get into the Sinai Peninsula. That's way down there. It's not impossible that David was there, but I think he's more probably in Maon. So we're going to take it there. Now, notice that David didn't go to the public funeral for Samuel, which is kind of sad. It's ironic that while the whole nation is publicly mourning Samuel, the man whom Samuel anointed as king is hiding out and is on the run. He had to get further away from Saul, and he had to provide for his numerous followers, which are up to 600 by now. Now, there was probably no connection with Samuel's death and David's retreat. David had to get food. And as one of my commentators says, quote, "Like other wildernesses, it," if it was the desert of Paran, "presented large tracts of natural pasture to which the people sent their cattle at the grazing seasons, but where they were liable to constant and heavy depredations by prowling Arabs. David and his men earned their subsistence by making reprisals on the cattle of these freebooting Ishmaelites. And frequently, for their useful services, they obtained voluntary tokens of acknowledgement from the peaceful inhabitants." In other words, David was a hired hand, a mercenary who protected people's sheep from marauding Arabs, Ishmaelites down there. And that would be a good place to do it, down there in the wilderness of Paran. Well, I don't know. He could have done it in Maon, too. Now, Samuel died, was buried at Ramah. That's where his house was. Adam Clark says he was buried in his own private mausoleum. I don't know how Clark knows that, but at any rate, Samuel dies at Ramah, which, of course, is just a few miles north of Jerusalem. You go from Jerusalem, you hit Gibeah, that's where Saul's capital was, and you go a couple more miles, you hit Ramah, where Samuel lived and now died. Adam Clark says that, quote, "Samuel lived, as is supposed, about 98 years, was in the government of Israel before Saul from 16 to 20 years, and ceased to live, according to the Jews, about 4 months before the death of Saul. But according to Calmet," that's another commentator back then, "according to Calmet and others, 2 years before the death of Saul. But all this is very uncertain. How long he died before Saul cannot be ascertained. But anyway, he did die before Saul." We go down to 1 Samuel 25, verses 2 through 3. "Now there was a man in Maon whose business was in Carmel," and the fact that Maon is mentioned here makes it sense that David was at Maon, not all the way down in the wilderness of Paran. "Now there was a man in Maon whose business was in Carmel." And remember, Carmel is about 1 or 2 miles north of Maon, going north as you go toward Hebron. "And the man was very rich, and he had 3,000 sheep and 1,000 goats. And it came about while he was shearing his sheep in Carmel Now this man's name was Nabal, and his wife's name was Abigail. And the woman was intelligent and beautiful in appearance, but the man was harsh and evil in his dealings, and he was a Calebite. Now the word Nabal means a fool. Now his parents probably didn't name him Nabal. What parent would name his child fool? It was probably a nickname given to him after people watched his doings. Abigail means my father's joy. Isn't that a great name, my father's joy? Adam Clark says that Abigail, asking the question, why would Abigail be married to such a moron? Adam Clark says, quote, she was, quote, married to the boor mentioned above, i.e. Nabal, probably because he was rich. Many women have been thus sacrificed. Ain't that the truth? Abigail is said to be intelligent and beautiful. It's a stereotype to say that beautiful women can't be intelligent. Abigail was both. It's also a stereotype to say that intelligent women can't be beautiful. Goes both ways. There are some who get blessed at birth with both. Now, Nabal is said to be a Calebite. Caleb means dog. So Nabal was a dog. Adam Clark and Jameson Foster and Brown say, i.e., Nabal had a canine disposition. In other words, to put it in plain, simple English, he was a jerk. As Matthew Poole says, quote, he came from a, quote, degenerate branch of that noble stock of Caleb, and consequently of the tribe of Judah, as David was. Because remember, Caleb was a good guy. Joshua and Caleb, the two spies that said, let's take the land. But apparently, you know, just because you got great ancestors doesn't mean the descendants are good people. We go now to 1 Samuel 25, verses 4 through 8. I'm in the middle of a sentence, so let me go back and pick up verse, and actually verse 3 is a parenthesis, so let me go back to verse 2. It came about while he was shearing his sheep in Carmel, verse 2, verse 4, that David heard in the wilderness that Nabal was shearing his sheep. So David sent 10 young men, and David said to the young men, go up to Carmel, visit Nabal, and greet him in my name. And thus you shall say, have a long life, peace be to you, and peace be to your house, and peace be to all that you have. Now I have heard that you have shearers. Now your shepherds have been with us, and we have not insulted them, nor have they missed anything all the days they were in Carmel. Ask your young men, and they will tell you. Therefore let my young men find favor in your eyes, for we have come on a festive day. Please give whatever you find at hand to your servants and to your son David. Now, Nabal was a rich man, and David certainly felt like he would be a good person. Nabal would be a good person to ask for help, especially since he had protected his sheep. So David tells his young men, go up to Carmel. That's because Carmel's higher up on the hills there than Maon was. And he says, now when you address him, say, have a long life. In other words, be nice, be peaceful, collect your money. Don't do anything to irritate him. And he tells the young men, David does, he says, now tell him that your Nabal's shepherds have been with us and we have not insulted them. Apparently Nabal was feeding his sheep in the same area where David was. And when the young men are to say that the shepherds of Nabal have not missed anything, it means that the people of David, the men of David, had not stolen anything. It also, I'm sure, means nobody stole anything from you, Nabal, because we were protecting you. So that's why they haven't missed anything. We haven't stolen anything, and neither has anybody else, because we were looking after your sheep and your shepherds. So let my young men find favor. David tells the young men to ask Nabal, for we have come on a festive day. That would be the sheep shearing festival, very common. And he says, notice he says, please get whatever you find at hand. In other words, leftovers. Don't go out of your way. Just anything that you can spare, just leftovers from the feast, as Adam Clark says. And Clark says this was a very reasonable and modest request, and it was. And then he tells the servants to tell Nabal in verse 8, please give whatever you find at hand to your servants and to your son David. Why does he call him your son? Why does David style himself as Nabal's son? Well, Nabal is older. Nabal is from the same tribe as Judah, perhaps. We go now to 1 Samuel 25, verses 9 through 11. When David's young men came, they spoke to Nabal according to all these words in David's name. Then they waited. But Nabal answered David's servants and said, who is David? And who is the son of Jesse? There are many servants today who are each breaking away from his master. Shall I then take my bread and my water and my meat that I have slaughtered for my shearers and give it to men whose origin I do not know? Well, when Nabal says, who is David? Well, it's obviously Nabal knows who David is. He called him the son of Jesse. So what he's really asking for is not for the identity of David, but for the status of David. And just who are you? You're a nobody. You're a nothing. And then Nabal says, there are many servants today who are each breaking away from his master. Now, that could be a reference to David's dispute with Saul, that David is breaking away from Saul, his master, and thus casting all the blame for that breach on David, not Saul. Or it might be, Nabal might be implying that David's 10 men have broken away from David. He's saying, how do I know you're from David? Well, he says, should I give my bread to men whose origin I do not know? Well, that's true. He didn't know the 10 men's origin, but he did know David's origin. He called him son of Jesse, so that could be what he's talking about. I suspect it was. At any rate, it's all an excuse. He should have known that David had protected his sheep, David and his men. He says, I'm not going to give my bread and my water. Now, that's short way of saying, I'm not going to give the food that I have. Obviously, he had fare better than just bread and water. He was a rich man having a feast. We go now to 1 Samuel chapter 25, verses 12 through 16. So David's young men retraced their way and went back, and they came and told him according to all these words. David said to his men, each of you gird on his sword. David's mad now. So each man girded on his sword, and David also girded on his sword, and about 400 men went up behind David, while 200 stayed with the baggage. But one of the young men told Abigail, Nabal's wife, saying, behold, David sent messengers from the wilderness to greet our master, and he scorned them. Yet the men were very good to us, and we were not insulted, nor did we miss anything as long as we went about with them while we were in the fields. They were a wall to us, both by night and by day, all the time we were with them tending the sheep. All right, first of all, notice that David left 200 men at the baggage and took 400 with him. That means he's got 600 men. He started out with 400 at the very beginning. 1 Samuel 22:2, everyone who was in distress, everyone who was in debt, and everyone who was discontented gathered to David, and he became captain over them. Now there were about 400 men with him. So David had already picked up 200 men. In fact, it happened in the last couple of chapters. It actually states that he picked up 200 men. I don't have the site with me, but he's up to 600 now. So he's getting stronger and stronger as Saul becomes more and more alienated from God, already completely alienated from Samuel. So one of the young men, that's Nabal's young men, told Abigail, hey, David was a good man. We didn't miss anything, he said. That means they didn't steal from us, and they protected us. They were like a wall to us both night and day. In other words, they protected us. And it's very ironic, the very sheep that Nabal was shearing at his sheep shearing festival wouldn't have been there to be sheared if it hadn't been for David, and then Nabal doesn't want to give him any reward for his work. And remember, David is in a wilderness needing food badly for 600 people. So this is serious business. I mean, David could have starved, and he did everything right, and he was getting screwed by Nabal. So we go to 1 Samuel 25, verses 17 through 18. Now therefore, know and consider what you should do, for evil is plotted against our master and against all his household, and he is such a worthless man that no one can speak to him. That, of course, is the men talking to Nabal's men who had kept his sheep, Nabal's sheep. They're now telling Abigail, what are you going to do? Evil is plotted against us. In other words, David's coming after us. How did Nabal's servant know that? Well, he could have heard David's messengers muttering as they left to go back to David when Nabal insulted them. Nabal's servant could have heard the men saying, well, that Nabal, what a jerk. We're going to get him. Or maybe the servant of Nabal just figured out that David would be angry and plotting revenge just from the circumstances. David already had a great reputation as a warrior. He had already killed Goliath and a lot of Philistines, and now we've just slapped him in the face. So he didn't have to be a prophet to know that David was going to come after him. So Abigail, this is what she does. She takes 200 loaves of bread, 2 jugs, that's an ASB, Holman Christian Study Bible has wineskins. They didn't have jugs back then. They kept it in wineskins. 5 sheep already prepared. That prepared, that means that they were butchered, dressed, ready for eating. Oh, it sounds good. 5 measures of roasted grain, 100 clusters of raisins, 200 cakes of figs, loaded them on donkeys. Donkeys, plural. She got so much food for David, there was too much food to put on just one donkey. She hurried to do this. She was in a big hurry. We go to 1 Samuel 25, verses 19 through 22. She, that's Abigail, said to her young men, go on before me. Behold, I am coming after you. But she did not tell her husband Nabal. It came about as she was riding on her donkey and coming down by the hidden part of the mountain, that behold, David and his men were coming down toward her. So she met them. Now David had said, "Surely in vain I have guarded all that this man has in the wilderness, so that nothing was missed of all that belonged to him, and he has returned me evil for good." David is angry. "May God do so to the enemies of David," David continues, "and more also, if by morning I leave as much as one male of any who belong to him." David's planning on killing them all, not just Nabal, but also the servants of Nabal, who really didn't have anything to do with this. Now notice that Abigail sent her servants on ahead of her with the food to David. She came afterwards. She wanted to see if her gifts would actually mollify David. If they didn't, if her servants came back and said, "Didn't do any good, Abigail, he's still coming," she'd have to go to plan B, whatever that might be. Now notice in verse 19, Abigail did not tell her husband Nabal what was going on. Well, he's drunk that night after the feast. This is probably the next morning that this is going on. I know this is probably the same, I suspect it's the same evening. And she didn't tell Nabal. Now, of course, the standard instruction to a good Christian wife is you don't hide things from your husband. Likewise, husbands don't hide things from their wives. But Abigail did. But now, note, this is a special situation. If she had told Nabal, if she had not given all those presents to David, her husband Nabal and all of Nabal's family would have died. This was a situation of necessity. So, no, she's not acting very submissive. But, you know, this business about Christian women submitting to their husbands, Paul is talking to Christians. He's expecting them to behave as Christians. He's saying, submit yourself to a husband who has been enjoined to treat his wife like a fellow heir of the grace of life, to wash her with the water of the word. He's not talking about submitting to Nabal's. I mean, it's amazing. I've seen women that'll submit themselves to getting beaten and abused and all. Well, they should get a gun, put it right between the husband's head, and says, "If you do this one more, if you hit me or my child one more time, I'm pulling the trigger, buddy." Submission is, I believe in Christian submission of wives, but I don't believe in the abuse of wives. Just like I believe you should submit to the government, but not when the government tells you you're not supposed to preach the gospel. Submission to authority assumes that the authority is operating within its proper sphere. Well, enough of that soapbox. Abigail had to not tell Nabal. And even if she had, it wouldn't have done any good to tell him. It would have taken too long to convince Nabal, you need to do something. You need to mollify David. By the time he got out of his drunken stupor, David would have been there and killed them all. She had no choice. Now, somewhere while all this is going on, verse 21, verse 22, it says that David had said, "May God do so to the enemies of David." David did not turn the other cheek here, folks. So here's the ethical question. Was David justified in planning to kill Nadab and his family? Now, the rabbis, the Jewish rabbis, like to justify David. They say that Nabal knew that David was anointed king by Samuel. Therefore, Nabal had just committed treason by not inviting David to the feast. So David was justified in killing Nabal. Well, I find that worthy of a Jesuit casuist expert. He wasn't king yet. I don't think David was justified in killing Nabal. Now, he might have come up there and worked him over a little bit and stolen some of his goods in payment. Not really stealing, but just taking what was owed him. That's what he should have done, in my humble opinion. Now, John Gill agrees with me. He says, quote, "This must be imputed to the sudden and violent passion David was thrown into when off his guard. Through the necessity he was in, the disappointment he met with, and the opprobrious language he was treated with. But in this, his conduct was not as it used to be, and as it was towards Saul, his enemy. Nor is his rage and passion to be vindicated, or the rash vow he made to destroy Nabal and his family. His crime, though great, yet not to be punished with death. His ingratitude and insolence deserved resentment, but were not capital crimes worthy of death, and especially of the destruction of his whole family." I think that's absolutely true. Adam Clark also agrees with Gill here. Quote, "Nothing can justify this part of David's conduct. Whatever his provocation might have been, he had suffered, properly speaking, no wrongs." Now, I question that. Clark is overstating the case. Yes, he had. He'd been screwed, but not enough to get to kill him. To kill Nabal. "And his," Clark continues, "and his, David's, resolution to cut off a whole innocent family because Nabal had acted ungenerously towards him was abominable and cruel, not to say diabolic. He who attempts to vindicate this conduct of David is, at least constructively, a foe to God in truth. David himself condemns this most rash and unwarrantable conduct and thanks God for having prevented him from doing this evil. We read that in 1 Samuel 25, 32. So let's read that in verse 33 also. Then David said to Abigail, "Blessed be the Lord God of Israel who sent you this day to me. And blessed be your discernment, and blessed be you, who have kept me this day from bloodshed and from avenging myself by my own hand." So David's happy Abigail stopped him in his heat of passion. He was not justified in killing Nabal. Now David swears in verse 2 that he's going to kill any male that belongs to Nabal. Now the King James translates that literally. He says, David has vowed that he's going to kill anyone in Nabal's camp that pisseth against the wall. And I love that verse. I remember I was talking to a friend of mine who was being tempted by King James only, and he would only let his daughter read the King James Bible. I said, I want to tell you something. I will not let my daughters read a Bible that has the word piss in it. Whew, that cooled him off. And he said, what do you mean? And I referred him to this verse here. That's the last time I heard anything about King James only out of him. Now, anybody that pisses against the walls, not only men, it could be talking about a dog. It could be that David was saying not even a dog of Nabal would be left. We go down to 1 Samuel 25, verses 23 through 26. When Abigail saw David, she hurried and dismounted from her donkey and fell on her face before David and bowed herself to the ground. She fell at his feet and said, "On me alone, my lord, be the blame. And please let your maidservant speak to you and listen to the words of your maidservant. Please do not let my lord pay attention to this worthless man, Nabal, for as his name is, so is he." Remember, Nabal means foolish. "Nabal is his name, and folly is with him." Folly is foolishness. "But I, your maidservant," Abigail continues, "did not see the young men of my lord whom you sent." Nabal had met them first and told them off, and Abigail wasn't there. "Now therefore," Abigail continues, my lord David, as the Lord lives, Yahweh lives, and as your soul lives, since Yahweh, the Lord, has restrained you from shedding blood and from avenging yourself by your own hand, now then let your enemies and those who seek evil against my lord," against David, "be as Nabal. May your enemies, David, be like Nabal." Now Abigail, she comes around the hidden part of the mountain, it says in the previous verses. She sees David coming towards her. She probably recognized David because he was the leader, people attending him and so forth. So she bows down with tremendous respect. Great contrast with Nabal. She calls Nabal this foolish man. Again, that's not standard advice for wives. You don't go around to your women's Bible study and talk about how stupid your husband is. Please pray for him. You just don't do that. Now she says, "On me alone, my lord, be the blame." She's trying to take the blame. And yet the very next verse she calls Nabal foolishness. Now that's strange. And Abigail was not in any way at all to be blamed for this. Maybe she's saying, well, I wish I'd have been there to stop this, but I wasn't there. Now when she calls Nabal a fool, Nabal is name and folly is with him. It's basically she's saying, my husband Nabal's a fool. It could be she's trying to say, look, he was stupid, but he was not malevolent. He was just socially insensitive, David. He wasn't trying to hurt you. He's just an idiot. Adam Gill says, in accordance with that sentiment, quote, she observes that Nabal is a fool, not to reproach him with it, but to excuse his sin, his rudeness, and ingratitude, and preserve his life, and suggest that what he had done was not to be imputed to malice in his heart, but to his stupidity and folly. Now that's interesting because we always think she's just dumping on him. He's an idiot. He's a fool. But she was probably trying to save his life. He didn't really mean it. He's just stupid. Now, Abigail had reason to be concerned about Nabal being killed. It's not good to be a widow in those times. There's no job market for widows. She would have inherited all of Nabal's goods, so she would have had a lot of wealth, I guess, that way. But still, she would have been a widow, and that's not good. Now, Abigail tells David, the Lord has restrained you from shedding blood. How did she know that? David was on his way to kill Nabal, and he just hadn't managed to get there yet, and she managed to stop him on his way. But how did she know that the Lord had restrained David from his murderous intentions? Well, perhaps she saw it in David's face. Perhaps she's speaking in advance in order to persuade David. The Lord's restrained you, David. Don't you agree with me? But at any rate, notice how Abigail modestly refrains from giving herself the credit for David restraining from bloodshed. The Lord has restrained you, not me, Abigail. And then she says, David, you're such a great guy. May all your enemies be as Nabal. John Gill says of this quote, that they, the enemies of Nabal, David's enemies, might be as inconsiderable as Nabal, as unable, as weak, and impotent as he to do him any hurt, and impotent as Nabal to do David any hurt and is short-lived and cut off by the hand of God, as Nabal would be. So Abigail, having modestly said the Lord has restrained David, not her foresight and generosity in giving food to David and his men, but God has done it. We go now to 1 Samuel 25, verses 27 through 29. Now let this gift, Abigail continues, which your maidservant has brought to my lord, be given to the young men who accompany my lord. Please forgive the transgression of your maidservant, for the Lord will certainly make for my lord an enduring house. The Lord Yahweh will certainly make for my lord David an enduring house, because my lord David is fighting the battles of Yahweh, and evil will not be found in you all your days. Should anyone rise up to pursue you and to seek your life, then the life of my lord David shall be bound in the bundle of the living with the Lord your God. But the lives of your enemies he will sling out as from the hollow of a sling. Now Abigail says, please pardon my transgression in verse 28. What transgression? Well, maybe interrupting David in his journey, or my transgression in taking the responsibility for Nabal's sins. She's really being very modest here. She hasn't done anything wrong, but she's talking about her transgressions. She tells David that David is fighting the battles of Yahweh, referring to the battles of the Philistines, of course. And she says, evil will not be found in you all your days. The NIV translates that as, let no wrongdoing be found in you as long as you live. And the King James says, evil hath not in the past, hath not been found in thee all thy days. So it depends on how you translate it, what she's really saying. If the past tense is correct, that evil has not been found in all your days in the past, then Abigail here is stating clearly that she doesn't believe any of Saul's lies about how David is a traitor. Now, if it's talking about the future, evil will not be found, as the NASB has it, in the future. That's her wish. That actually didn't happen, because David, because of his sins, had a lot of trouble. Remember Uriah, Bathsheba, Ammon, Tamar, and all that, which we'll get to shortly. Now, notice she says in verse 29, should anyone rise up to pursue you and to seek your life? She's talking about Saul there, but she doesn't mention his name. After all, Saul is king. She doesn't want to sound treasonous. Treason has severe consequences. She said, the life of my lord David shall be bound in the bundle of the living. An interesting phrase, a bundle of the living. John Gill says of this phrase, quote, should be dear unto the Lord. This phrase means, quote, should be dear unto the Lord, precious in his esteem, and be carefully preserved by him, among other his chosen ones, and should be safe with him, in his hands, and under his care and keeping. In other words, David, let God preserve you forever. But let your enemies be slung at us from the hollow of a sling, like a rock coming out of a sling. 1 Samuel 25, verses 30 through 31. And when the Lord does for my Lord, when the Lord Yahweh does for my Lord David, according to all the good that he has spoken concerning you, and appoints you ruler over Israel, this will not cause grief or a troubled heart to my Lord, both by having shed blood without cause, and by my Lord having avenged himself. When the Lord deals with my Lord, then remember your maidservant. Now, Abigail refers to all the good that Yahweh has done, has spoken concerning David. What good that God has spoken concerning David? Well, that which Samuel had spoken to David when Samuel promised David the kingdom. That's what she's referring to. And she says, you won't have grief as a troubled heart when you rule over Israel. You won't have grief because you didn't shed blood without cause. So Abigail here is very politely and subtly pointing out to David that he was not right in killing Nabal. She says, by having shed blood without cause. So Abigail didn't think it was right for Nabal to be killed either, and I think she was exactly right. Especially when you consider David wanting to kill Nabal's family and his servants. They had nothing to do with Nabal's foolishness. Verse 31 says, Abigail says, you will not have grief or a troubled heart by having shed blood without cause, and by having my Lord avenge himself. Now, the NIV translates that as, quote, my master, David, will not have on his conscience the staggering burden of needless bloodshed or of having avenged himself. So Abigail's a good woman. She saved David from a world of trouble, a world of sin. When the Lord dwells well with my Lord, when the Lord Yahweh deals well with my Lord David, then remember your maidservant. Verse 31. What does she mean when God deals well with David? Well, when God delivers David from Saul, could be, or she could be referring further on when God made David king of Israel. And then she says, remember me, David. Now remember can mean call to memory something that happened in the past, but it also can mean do something good to me, like remember me in your will. There's two meanings in English here. And so what she's saying is, do me good in the future. Well, David's going to do her good, all right. He's going to make her his wife, one of his wives, which means she might even be queen one day. She didn't end up being queen, but she could have been. She could have, when she says, remember me, I don't think she's thinking about marrying him, but she could have been saying, David, please remember my advice not to take vengeance. Remember how I saved you. And so, therefore, remember me, Abigail, when you're king and I need help in something. Just look out for me, will you? Well, he did more than that. He made Abigail his wife. We go down to 1 Samuel 25, verses 32 through 34. Then David said to Abigail, blessed be the Lord God of Israel, who sent you this day to meet me. And blessed be your discernment, and blessed be you who have kept me this day from bloodshed and from avenging myself by my own hand. Nevertheless, as the Lord God of Israel lives, who has restrained me from harming you, unless you had come quickly to meet me, surely there would not have been left in Nabal until the morning light as much as one male. Notice how the Lord God restrained David and Abigail restrained David in these verses. That shows that God's sovereignty and man's free will works perfectly compatibly. David tells Abigail, you've kept me from bloodshed. David knew that Abigail had kept him from completing a foolish and rash vow. As John Gill says, vengeance belongs only to God. It was up to David to let God punish Nabal, not him. Now, the application of all this is a good wife will keep her husband from doing something stupid. It's happened many times in a good marriage. A husband will get in his mind something ridiculous and stupid. And the wife has got to be very nice and very submissive and say, don't do that, you idiot! Well, maybe not quite so bluntly, but she's got to keep, you know, she's got to say, I'll pray about that. If you want to do it, I'll do it because I'm your submissive wife, but I really think you're an idiot. I'm being facetious, please. Of course, she shouldn't be quite that rude and blunt about it. Notice how Abigail was very polite to David as she was. In fact, we have no notice anywhere of Abigail being obnoxious toward Nabal. She didn't tell him what was going on, but she didn't go out and say, Nabal, you're a fool, just like her name. She never did that. Smart woman. Now David says, oh, praise God for Abigail who restrained me from harming you, Abigail. Well, how would Abigail have been harmed? She wouldn't have been directly harmed. David wasn't going to kill the women, folks, just the men. But she would have been indirectly harmed because all her male relatives would have been killed. And she not only would have been a widow, she would have not had male relatives to look after her. We go down to 1 Samuel 25, verses 35 through 38. So David received from her hand what she had brought him and said to her, go up to your house in peace. See, I have listened to you and granted your request. Then Abigail came to Nabal, and behold, he was holding a feast in his house like the feast of a king. That's why I'm saying the feast is still going on. It's that evening as Abigail returns from David. And Nabal's heart was merry within him, for he was very drunk. So she did not tell him anything at all until the morning light. But in the morning, when the wine had gone out of Nabal, his wife told him these things, and his heart died within him, so that he became as a stone. About 10 days later, the Lord struck Nabal, and he died. Now Abigail got back to Nabal in the evening time before that morning, before the feast. Well, after the feast, I'm sure he was very drunk. He had just feasted from celebrating at a sheep shearing festival. She tells him what happened the next morning. I guess she figured she couldn't keep it secret from him any longer. I don't know. She could have kept quiet about it, but she told him. And Nabal responds by going into shock. His heart died within him. He became as a stone. I take that to mean that he just was drunk, or formerly drunk, and he was just shocked, so shocked that he might have died. He came with an ace of getting himself killed and all of his relatives, that he just went in to a catatonic state and died 10 days later. Maybe he had a stroke, maybe. We go now to 1 Samuel 25, verse 39. When David heard that Nabal was dead, he said, blessed be the Lord, who has pleaded the cause of my reproach from the hand of Nabal, and has kept back his servant, i.e. David, from evil. David saying, you've kept me from evil, God. The Lord has also returned the evil doing of Nabal on his own head, David continues. Then David sent a proposal to Abigail to take her as his wife. Now we have a little ethical problem here. David hears that Nabal's dead and he says, blessed be the Lord. Is that not an example of schadenfreude? Reminds me of I was performing a funeral, and after the funeral we're standing at the graveside, and one of the relatives was telling me about a woman who had married a man. She was a hairdresser in my local town,
and her husband had been abusing her for several years, and finally he got physical about it, and she finally went to the gun that was kept to protect the hair salon from criminals and robbers. She took that gun and blew him away. And when I heard that, I said, "Praise the Lord." And they laughed because they thought I was being funny. I wasn't being funny. Some people deserve to die. But that's a close question. I admit it. So here's the problem. Is David rejoicing too much over the death of his enemies? Now, here's one commentator who says that, yes, he was rejoicing too much. That's Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown. They say this, quote, "If this was an expression of pleasure and David's vindictive feelings were gratified by the intelligence of Nabal's death, it was an instance of human infirmity which we may lament." Well, but you could look at it another way. You could say that David is speaking from a sense of justice, not private revenge. God did what was right. Blessed be the Lord. John Gill says this, "Not that he rejoiced at the death of Nabal simply considered or from a private spirit of revenge, but because of the glory of divine justice, which he had shown to him in vindicating him from the reproach Nabal had cast upon him." That might be true, but it sure sounded like private revenge. Given the circumstances, he had just been involved in a private dispute with Nabal. Well, that's true, but on the other hand, he could have just been praising God for keeping David from killing Nabal. He says, "Blessed be the Lord, who has kept back his servant from evil. Who has kept back his servant from evil. Blessed be the Lord." So David might not be expressing private revenge. He might either be expressing the happiness at divine justice, or he could be expressing happiness that God has kept him from an act of private revenge that would have stained his honor forever. I don't think we're going to hold David responsible for anything there. And then David sent a proposal to Abigail to take her as his wife. Now, there's a problem here. David already had a wife, Michal, and we'll see later in the next verse. He also already had another wife called Ahinoam, most probably. Well, how can you explain that? Well, the easiest way to explain it is the way that Adam Clark does. It was common to have more than one wife back then. Remember, polygamy was the fashion. And not only that, Michal had been taken away by Saul. She was living in adultery with another man, as we'll see here in a few verses, a guy named Palti. And maybe Ahinoam was not married beforehand, so maybe he was still monogamous, and Abigail would then be his first wife. But I don't think so. I think that Ahinoam was already married to David. Now, note here, David wants her as his wife. He's only met her once. This is fast action here. But remember, she's wealthy. David needs money. I mean, I hate to be so unromantic about things, but this is a very practical arrangement. She was also intelligent and beautiful. I'm sure that affected David also. But at any rate, he got her property, and so by the providence of God, David is getting stronger and stronger as he gets ready to take over the kingdom, as he is being graduated by God from being a freebooter wandering around in the desert to being a monarch. Now, why didn't David ask Abigail face to face? Why did he have to send a messenger? This reminds me of modern guys. Oh, they go to the girl, a friend of the girl they want to date or get with. They say, "Do you think does she like me? Does she like me? Does she like me?" Gutless. Gutless. "Oh, I don't know. She's going through so much right now. I don't know if this is the proper time for me to date her." Gutless. Men today are gutless when it comes to pursuing women, speaking as a general rule. It's a terrible problem. Well, do we want to say that David is gutless here? I don't think so. Well, we could say that. I mean, David is poor, he's persecuted, and she's rich, so he might have been worried that she might refuse him. I think more likely, though, David didn't want it to make it look like he took Abigail by force. After all, he got 600 men behind him, her husband's dead. He could have easily just taken her, but he didn't want to do that. He was trying to protect her honor. And besides, as Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown says, sending messages to ones proposed was the common style of Eastern monarchs. Let me read this quote from Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown. Quote, "This unceremonious proceeding was quite in the style of Eastern monarchs, who no sooner take a fancy for a lady than they dispatch a messenger to intimate their royal wishes that she should henceforth reside in the palace, and her duty is implicitly to obey. David's conduct shows that the manners of the Eastern nations were already imitated by the great men in Israel, and that the morality of the times which God permitted gave its sanction to the practice of polygamy." So Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown says that message is more like a ultimatum rather than a request. I don't think so. It says it's a proposal. A proposal is not an ultimatum. But at any rate, he gets his girl.
We go now to 1 Samuel chapter 25, verses 40 through 42. When the servants of David came to Abigail at Carmel, they spoke to her, saying, David has sent us to you to take you as his wife. She arose and bowed with her face to the ground and said, Behold, your maidservant is a maid to wash the feet of my lord's servants. Then Abigail quickly arose and rode on a donkey with her five maidens who attended her, and she followed the messengers of David and became his wife. Now the servants of David came to Abigail at Carmel. Remember, Abigail lived at Maon, most probably. Carmel is a couple miles north on the road there, coming from En-Gedi at the intersection of the road that goes north to Hebron and east to En-Gedi. So David goes there where Abigail is, right north of where Abigail lived. And they say, Abigail, would you be David's wife? Now notice how Abigail is so modest here. She bowed with her face to the ground. Then she washed the feet of David's servants. Now, anybody that wants to take Nabal as the paragon of a rebellious wife because she hid some information from her worthless husband need to consider these verses. She was a humble woman as well as being intelligent and beautiful. She has five maidens when she goes to meet David and become his wife. She was a wealthy woman. She had five maidens to take care of her. Why was she in Carmel instead of Maon? John Gill speculates it's because Abigail had a house in Carmel, or Nabal had a house up there in Carmel as well as in Maon. Now we might ask the question, why did Abigail accept the proposal of a poor outlaw? Because remember, that's just what David was at this time. Well, here's a possible answer. She knew that one day David was going to be king. She had heard of the prophecies of Samuel, as I'm sure everybody else had. And then the thought might have crossed her mind, well, she might be a queen. Now, of course, this is not obvious. David had another wife, Michal, and perhaps Ahinoam, as we'll see in a minute. But whether she's going to be queen or not, she's going to be married to a king, and she probably has faith. Having watched David and heard of his reputation, she probably figured this would be a good man to marry. Even if it's a poor outlaw now, he's not going to stay there. Now, in verse 42, we see that Abigail followed the messengers she sent back to David. Why did she follow her own messengers? Well, that would give the messengers enough time to let David know of her answer so she wouldn't just pop in on David unawares. It would give him time to contemplate whether she had said yes or no. In this case, yes. So then he could say, "Why, dog, I got me a wife," so he could properly prepare himself to receive Abigail personally. Now we read now in verses 43 and 44, 1 Samuel 25, and we'll be finished with this chapter. David had also taken Ahinoam of Jezreel, and they both became his wives. That means Abigail and Ahinoam. Now Saul had given Michal his daughter, David's wife, to Palti, the son of Laish, who was from Galim. Now that translation there, David had taken Ahinoam. I just read in another context that the Hebrew has no pluperfect, past perfect, had taken. And so I guess this might be, you could translate it, David took Ahinoam of Jezreel, and so the time aspect is not, the time of the taking is not precisely stated by the Hebrew verb there. But I think it's reasonable to say that Ahinoam was taken before. And the reason for that is, as Adam Clark says, Ahinoam is always mentioned first in the lists of David's wives. Also, she was the mother of David's eldest son, Ammon. Well, the eldest son is not necessarily, but most probably, going to be the coming from the oldest wife. So we'll assume that. So now David has got two wives. We don't know much about Ahinoam, but we know something about Abigail. He's got two wives. He's lost Michal, but he's got two wives. Now, again, we've got to remember, just because he's got two wives, that's not an example for us that it's okay to have two wives today. As John Gill says, polygamy, though not agreeable to the law of nature nor the law of God, was a custom which prevailed in those times, which good men gave into, though not to be commended for it. Well, David's terrible family history is certainly not a recommendation for polygamy. Remember the strife between Ammon and Absalom, if I remember correctly. Ammon and Tamar, the incest between the half-brothers and the half-sisters, and maybe even a rape. I mean, David had a horrible family life. Polygamy is not the way to go, folks. I'm sure none of you have been tempted that way. We got the worst problem today is people don't want to get married for the first wife, much less two. Now, why had Saul given David's wife away, Michal? Well, he could have done it just to irritate David. But probably he had more pragmatic reasons. Michael being gone would break David's family ties with the throne of Saul, so David could not use Michael as a help to ascend to the throne of Israel. Well, that makes sense. After all, Michael's already helped David escape when Saul's messengers were surrounded his house at Gibeah and tried to get him. Now, this Paltiel that Michael was given to is also known as Paltiel. 2 Samuel 3:15, Paltiel is mentioned there. Now, this Paltiel, also known as Paltiel, is committing adultery when he takes Michael as his wife because Michael was already married to David. And as a matter of fact, she's going to later end up being back with David. So that wasn't so smart as to take another man's wife, even if the king is and the girl's father is giving her to you. Now, this Paltiel is from a place called Galim, or at least it's either Laish is from Galim or Paltiel is from Galim. You can't really tell which it is, but Galim is probably a city in the tribe of Benjamin. It's mentioned with several other cities of Benjamin in Isaiah 10:29-30, which I'm not going to read. It's absolutely of minor importance. John Gill says it's near Gibeah of Saul, which is right north of Jerusalem, a couple miles. So that's where Paltiel's from. And then Ahinoam is from Jezreel, and that's not probably not the famous Jezreel up in the Jezreel Valley, up to the north there in Manasseh. But this, as Easton's has, is its second definition, a town in Judah to the southeast of Hebron. Ahinoam, one of David's wives, probably belonged to Jezreel. Well, southeast of Hebron is right around where we are now, Maon, Carmel, which makes you think that David had picked up another wife while he was down there on his food foraging expeditions. At any rate, ladies and gentlemen, we have now finished this relatively long chapter of 1 Samuel 25. We are now ready to go to chapter 26, verses 1 through 24, and we will see that David spares Saul's life again. He'd already done it at the cave of En-Gedi. He's going to do it again. Hope you stay tuned for that next audio, and I hope you enjoyed this one.